Miss Lucy.
Is there going to be lights on the stage? Lights here?
Miss Lucy at the lectern.
Good evening. Welcome to Dominican University of California. And welcome to One Book, One Marin 2009. Is this not an exciting evening? And I hope this isn't your first time at One Book, One Marin, but I know it will not be your last, because this is a fabulous event that we have here in Marin with the great support and invitation by the Marin Libraries, and it's just a great pleasure to have been invited by the County Marin Libraries to participate in this event. So it is my great pleasure to welcome you to Dominican. My name is Denise Lucy. I am a professor of business and the director of the Institute for Leadership Studies. And it would not be appropriate if I didn't mention that we have fabulous cultural events here on our campus. In fact, on May 13th, Daniel Goleman will be coming here because of the terrific partnership with Book Passage. So you need to come on May 13th, buy a book, meet Daniel Goleman, and you'll have a great evening then too. We also have some musical events this weekend. Look at our website, and please remember that we are Marin's University, and we hope that you'll come back as often as possible. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you our great host, Gail Hare, who is the director of the Marin County Libraries.
Thank you, Denise. And I'd like to thank Dominican University of California for hosting us once again. Their team, particularly Stacy Dorder and their marketing team, are always gracious and they're professional and flexible, and we can't thank them enough. And could we give them a hand, please? And we're just thrilled to return to Angelica Hall for the third celebration event of One Book, One Marin. And I want to thank you all for joining us and being part of our initiative, which is to read and discuss and to build community. And since we launched One Book, One Marin on February 5th at Book Passage, we've hosted more than 27 events at 22 locations throughout Marin County. And in keeping with our library's philosophy of always making our events free to anyone wishing to participate, you have participated. We have to thank the generosity of our local businesses, our elected officials, our libraries, and our other institutions that have really let us bring to life the richness of what is the what. The places, the sounds, the cultures, the issues that were raised in the book. We've had programs that included children's reading and art activities. We've had a great African dance and drumming program. We've done book discussion groups. We met in libraries. We met in living rooms. We met in community halls. And we set out to engage our community, and we're so pleased that you and hundreds of others like you in Marin County have chosen to become engaged with One Book, One Marin. I mentioned before that our events in One Book, One Marin is made possible through the generosity of many sources, and I'd like to read some of those names to you and get your help in acknowledging the financial and in-kind sponsors. And there's a long list, and if you could just hold your applause to the end, it'll go faster. Our founding members and our stalwart funders for their visionary leadership, the Marin County Free Library, the Friends of the Marin County Free Library, the Marin County Free Library Foundation, the Marin Community Foundation, Autodesk, the Friends of the San Rafael Public Library, the Marin Education Fund, the Belvedere Tiburon Library Foundation, the Honorable Charles McClashan, the Honorable Steve Kinsey, and Friends of the San Anselmo Library. And I'd also like to welcome our new sponsors who reassure us that we're doing the right thing with One Book, One Marin, and to welcome you all aboard as funders, the Bank of Marin, the San Rafael Public Library, the Friends of the Larkspur Library, the Honorable Hal Brown, the Friends of the Mill Valley Library, and the Friends of the Sausalito Library. And to continue our work, I'd ask that you remain engaged and that you invite your colleagues to join us. And I'd like to thank everyone again for your commitment to reading and building community, which is really important, I think, in these dislocated times. I'd like to take one more minute to acknowledge some other individuals and institutions without whom we would not be here. And these are the people we call our community sponsors. They devote time and energy throughout the year. They go to a lot of committee meetings to develop a program which brings us such illustrious authors as Isabel Allende and Amy Tan and this year Dave Eggers up close and personal for us. And they're all listed on your program, but I would like everyone who's here please to stand up so we can recognize you for your hard work. Well, we'll clap for them. And lastly, I want to acknowledge the educators throughout Marin County who this year heeded our call and encouraged students and parents to read our selection and to participate in special programs we did for teens, including last night's fabulously successful forum at St. Andrew Presbyterian Church in Marin City. And thank you all for showing these young adults how wonderful and how pleasurable reading can be throughout their lives. And as I conclude, I just want to let you know that we're continuing One Book, One Marin through 2009, and we encourage you to continue reading and discussing what is the what throughout the year. But we will be planning on making our 2010 selection in the fall, and we'll be looking forward to seeing you again next year. And be sure to provide your contact information to us so we can keep you informed of future programming. And there are cards that you can complete out in the foyer space as you leave this evening. One Book, One Marin is our community's opportunity to read and to discuss and to build community, and we look forward to growing with you in that experience. And finally, I would like to ask you to please join me in welcoming to the stage our gracious Mistress of Ceremonies, Elaine Petrocelli of Book Passage, whose advice, relationships, equanimity, and experience help our project beyond words. Elaine?
Hi. I wrote this really cool intro. I never usually write them. And then I left it on my bathroom counter. So what I want to tell you is how excited all of us were at Book Passage when What Is the What was published. It was one of those books that just changes your mind, teaches you so much. And last year's One Book, One Marin author, Amy Tan, came in as soon as the book was published and bought so many copies. And she had us wrap them up and mail them to every important person she had ever met. So this book, I think, may have changed some important minds, including, I'm sure, our own. It's really exciting that Valentino Achak Deng was willing to come here tonight because he's very busy. And he will tell you more about that in a few minutes. He has an amazing project in the small town of Mareel Bai in southern Sudan. When Valentino was a really little boy, civil war came to southern Sudan. And he was separated from his family. He was forced to join thousands of children, mostly boys, walking over 800 miles through war zones where there were animals that were hungry. And tens of thousands of children made this journey. They finally made it to a refugee camp in Ethiopia where they lived for 3 years. But when the Ethiopian regime changed, they were kicked out at the point of a gun, many of them being killed. And finally, they were put into a refugee camp in Kenya, in a very dusty spot. After 10 years there, a number of the boys, including Valentino, were brought to the United States. Valentino came to Atlanta, and this magnificent book starts in Atlanta. When he was in Atlanta, he was put in touch with the magnificent writer, Dave Eggers. Dave wrote his story with his help, and that book became the novel, What Is the What? Dave is one of the treasures, not only of Marin County, but of the literary world. He was the founder of 826 Valencius, which now has 7 tutoring places, you know, all over the country. We're hoping one will come to Marin. It's a place where kids go because it looks really interesting. And after they get there, they stay to learn to write. Famous authors teach at 826 Valencia, and they tell me when they're visiting Book Passage that their favorite day is always the day that they are teaching there. David, the first book I read by Dave was a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, written about the time when Dave was a senior in college. Both of his parents died within 5 weeks, and he inherited an 8-year-old brother whom he raised. His novel, You Shall Know Our Velocity, is great fun. You shouldn't miss it. About 2 guys going around the world trying to give away money. You'll laugh and you'll cry. His short story collection, How Are We Hungry, had the critics reeling as they said, nobody's ever written quite in this way. He edits, he writes. He's one of the most generous people I have ever met. And together, he and Valentino are doing great things. So I am so proud to introduce you to Dave Eggers and Valentino Achakdeng.
Thank you.
So, you've been in Marin many times before. What does it mean to have this, your story, chosen as One Book, One Marin? You know that everyone in the county is required by law. There are shakedowns. People will stop. Officials will stop you on the street, quiz you on it. What does it mean?
I don't think everyone is required. But first of all, I want to thank you so much for turning up for this event, and it means a lot to me that the Free Library in Marin County has chosen What Is the Word as One Book of the Year, and to me, the people of Marin, I should assume, that represent that very hope, that very courage that inspired me to tell my story. That's how I just want to put it simply. You represent that hope in Marin County.
Why did I'll ask you the question. Why, when you came to the U.S., you were a representative for hundreds of young men who had been resettled in Atlanta, and Mary Williams had, you know, helped organize a lot of events where you were speaking in front of people. Why was it that, one, you were the spokesperson, and why did you want to tell your story to so many, you know, to everybody? What did you find about Americans? What did they know about Sudan, and what did you want to tell them?
To cut it short, I had done some speaking event at the camp. I was a youth leader.
And at Kakuma?
Kakuma, and I was used to speaking to many teenagers. Most of them were my age mate at the time. And I was speaking to people about the issues that has a lot to do with reproductive health and HIV/AIDS and social issues. We had a drama club where we dramatized things that we could not speak about. But then when I came to Atlanta, that had changed. I saw in myself as somebody who should be an ambassador of the voiceless people of Sudan. I came to Atlanta at the time when the civil war in southern Sudan had claimed over 2.5 million lives. I came at the time when more than 4 million Southern Sudanese were internally displaced in Southern Sudan, and more than 500,000 left for foreign countries as refugees. So when I came to Atlanta, I looked at what I would do, maybe to share my story with Americans. And I got a job in Atlanta, and with that job, I used to take my lunch. You know, sometimes my boss was a good guy. He allowed me to combine many lunchtime together, and I would go to speak at a college, at a high school, at a corporate company. And through those speaking events, I realized that just speaking to a small group of people and speaking for 30 minutes was not enough. I needed to elaborate the story. I needed to share the story with many people and to get the story to many individuals. And the only way, one of the ways to do that would be to write a memoir. And because I was not a writer, another option was to be hooked up, let me use that term, with a writer who will help me tell my story. And that is the reason I did that. I wanted the message to reach many people.
The weekend that we met is in the book. I sort of airbrushed myself out of it. But it was January of 2003 when you and all of the other guys that were resettled in Atlanta were celebrating your birthday together. The birthday was January 1st. But we were celebrating
the birthday on January the 11th. But it occurred that many immigrants who come to the U.S. and many of my peers took January the 1st as their birthday. This was a given birthday, because in a person's ID in the U.S. you must have a birthday. And many of us did not remember their birthday. And January the 1st is a simple date to remember. So we all were given January the 1st. And in Atlanta, we had our organization. And on January, we put up that birthday event, yeah, which in some time was also a fundraising event for many of us. And that happened to be the weekend you came to Atlanta.
Yeah.
And Manut Bol was also... Maybe some of you know Manut Bol, the tallest Sudanese. He was in Atlanta. We had invited him to that birthday.
He was giving you all a working over, a talking to, you might say. He was really sort of urging all of the young men there to do well here in the U.S. and to be sort of, I think he used the phrase, model immigrants, so that you might invite more Sudanese that were at Kakuma to come over, you know, might enable more so-called lost boys to come.
We invited him as an elder and as an advisor as well, and he was an expert on American culture because he lived here longer than anybody. And we invited him to that party, and there was also a basketball game on that weekend.
The Atlanta Hawks, which... Yeah. At the time, it's loosely, you could call it basketball, I guess. But there were about as many people in the stadium. It was at the CNN Center, is that what they call it?
It was at, yeah.
There was CNN. About as many people there that day as there are here. Probably fewer. And the main attraction was the cheerleaders, I think. Do you remember? I remember watching you watch them. It was pure shock.
The Hawks, the Atlanta Hawks, weren't doing well at that time. The Orlando Magic was really beating our team. But one of the most interesting thing was that there were cheerleaders, and it was my first time to be in a basketball game and to see the cheerleaders dancing. It were as if our team was not losing. The cheerleaders have a firm courage. They were cheering and dancing and the music. And, you know, for me, I pay more attention on cheerleaders than the game. But it was a good time.
That was the weekend that we started. I flew out to Atlanta just to sort of meet Valentino and talk to Mary. I put him out of order. We have a picture of Mary that I thought we would show. Mary just said, you know, why don't you come out and meet Valentino? She had written me a letter. I got a letter in the mail at 826 Valencia one day that just said, I'm Mary Williams. I started an organization called the Lost Boys Foundation. I met a young man named Valentino. He's looking for a biographer. Do you want the job? And that was all in the first couple sentences. And so I was intrigued. But I went out to Atlanta just with no preconceptions or no plans. I just thought, well, at least we would talk about it and about what Valentino wanted out of the project. And we started, after the game the next day, we started just talking and sort of going through your story piece by piece. And pretty soon we had a rapport right away, I think. And then it wasn't until many months later, and even, I mean, that first couple weeks, I told Valentino, you know, when I knew that I had read a lot about the story of the so-called Lost Boys and the Civil War in Sudan, but there was so much more that hadn't been told. And I said, the story has to be told. We have to get it out there. I'll do it. I'll write it in a year, or I'll write it in 9 months. We'll publish it in a year.
It took us 4 years.
Yeah, I was... a ridiculous promise to make, so yeah. I always apologize. It took 4 years, and one of the, you know, and so much happened in that time, including going back to your hometown and to visit your family. And I maybe we'll wait to show those slides, but in the meantime, I just want to say Valentino now lives in Nairobi and flew in yesterday. To be here with you.
Thank you.
Now, people who have read your story know that the number of trials and tribulations that you've gone through are Job-like. But it doesn't end, and that's what. Since we've known each other, we've run out of gas in central Illinois with 10 below weather, and that was your fault, by the way. Valentino was driving. So, but the flight from Nairobi...
You were the engineer of the car.
Yeah, I was... Do you want to talk about the flight just from... Where was it? From which leg of the journey was it that this latest...
Oh, the flight from Juba to Nairobi.
Okay, so from Southern Sudan to Nairobi.
Yeah, on my way here, we took off from this small town in South Sudan called Juba, and I was going to Nairobi. But at the airport, I saw this young lady reading what is the what. and our flight was delayed, so we spent 5 hours at the airport. And she was sitting next to me. I came and then kept and was reading the book. And I didn't want to tell her that I was the one. But then I kept on saying, but this is unfair. And, but then we went on board the aircraft and I went before her. And then she came and sat next to me. Now I had no choice. After the flight took off, I told her that, you know, the book you're reading is about me. And she's like, no, you're kidding. It cannot be you. I said, yeah, isn't the guy called Valentino Achakdeng? Yeah. I said, I am the one. And the reason I'm telling you is just to make your day.
But you had to show your passport.
Yeah, and she goes like, really? Yeah. And she goes like, then show me your passport. And then I said, yes, let me check in again within the plane. And I gave her my passport, and she goes like, no, I cannot believe this. I cannot believe this. And then I said, believe it now. But after a few minutes, we talked, and then she went back reading the book. But then our flight, a terrible thing happened. Our flight was struck by lightning. Yeah. And we saw the sparkle. It was so terrible. We thought the plane was going to catch fire. And I sat like this, no talking. I said, maybe this is the day. Then after a few minutes, the pilot turned on the light and the crew started on serving us snacks. And then she goes like, this is good news. But yeah, that's what happened about that flight.
There's always a story. Anytime we're apart for like a month, there's some incredible story you come back with. But and in the book was published in 2006, and so much has happened. We're going to show some slides about everything that's happened since, and including who are these people?
Oh, this is me with my family. That's my son, Ro, my wife, and I. I am married, and we have a son who is 5 months old.
And you guys live in Nairobi so that you can have, because all of the supplies, you're building a school in your hometown of Marialbai, but everything has to go through Nairobi, and you have to sort of be close to a city and also fly in and out of Sudan.
Yeah, we buy almost every construction material from either Kampala or Nairobi. And also my wife happened to have been living in Nairobi, so I set up a temporal residence in Nairobi. That's between the U.S. and Marialbai. I go work in Marialbai and come to Nairobi for a week or 2 weeks. But yeah, Nairobi is now a temporary location for us.
I just love this picture, though, especially the shirt you're wearing, which is, I think I had here, had that exact same shirt in the 70s. It's the one time that Valentino always outdresses me, but I think I've got him on the shirt. All right. This is a ruined private shot with his SpongeBob SquarePants shirt, I don't think. So, and here's Mary Williams in the red. This is a picture taken in Philadelphia. There's the mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter. But there's Mary, in case she was the one that sort of dreamed up the whole project and connected us, and we owe her everything, and she's still, we're in constant touch with her. Last we heard, she was in Antarctica. She just got back. She's a world explorer, but yeah. Anyway. So, oh, wait, who are these people?
That's Bill Clinton.
Well, let's start. Let's move on, and we'll go back to that. So we'll show some pictures from Marialbai. When we went back at the end of 2003, where we had been doing interviews for many months, and then Mary arranged a trip where we could at least try to get back to Marialbai. The war was technically still going on in southern Sudan, but there was a ceasefire, and we were able to fly into Nairobi, and then we had to arrange a flight on an aid plane that was bringing supplies to various towns in southern Sudan, humanitarian aid, and we paid our way on so that they actually weighed us against some of the supplies, like a few bicycles that they were going to bring in, and we supplanted the bikes and sat in the back, you know, with all of the cargo, and then the plane landed many times along the way and dropped off supplies, and then the last stop was in Marialbai. And so you hadn't been home in 17 years.
Yes.
What was that like when you were descending, getting close to your hometown, seeing the landscape from above? Did you recognize it? And when you got off the plane, and who all did you see?
It was like a dream, a very difficult dream coming true, because I had spent 17 years away from the village. I left when I was young, and I left my country in a war-torn, I left my family in a war-torn region, and I had heard things about Marialbai, including statements such as Maria Alba is wiped out by Morajalin. Morajalin are the same group we call Janjaweed today. The group had only changed names, but it has prevailed for so long. And when I went back to Maria Alba, I was trying to put together, while the plane was approaching the ground, I was just trying to put together what things look like and what happened to the people. But surprisingly, the population of Maria Alba had reduced drastically. There were less than 1,000 people. And I think 50 or 100 people were at the airport waiting to receive us. As one of my secrets, I did not inform the family that we were coming, because we were not even sure that we were going to fly to Maria Alba. We were lucky we got the last flight to South Sudan. That was in December, and the NGO workers leave Sudan during December. And there was my father and my mother at the airport, and people were calling my name, Achak, Achak. These were my siblings and relatives and father and mom. My dad came and greeted me and went back and looked on, and my mom came and greeted me, and I just was there. I tried to imagine why the war and why, you know, what had these people done to be subjected to such atrocities, to such suffering. Nobody looked similar. My father's grown older, my mom has grown older, and so were many people at the airport. So we walked into the SEF, the children compound, and sat there for some time, exchanged words with my family, and then they went back to the house. But that moment gives me a sense of a different understanding of the situation in Sudan and of my own. That encounter with my family and with the people of Maria Alba made me realize that I didn't suffer as much. I was able to move between refugee camps and between different countries. And so all I did was flee, run away from conflict. But many people who were in southern Sudan faced it. They were there. Every single day, every single minute, they were bombed, they were displaced, their crops were burned in their front, their houses were burned, people's limbs were broken, and these people saw it all. And at that time I realized that I had the advantage of having left the country, and for that reason I had to think about what to do to the people of Sudan.
Well, let's look at some of these pictures. These were taken at various times. This was actually just about a year ago, or maybe this is over the summer that we took this. But what have you seen since you've been back in 2006, 2007, and, you know, just a few weeks ago? What's happening to the town now? There was peace, as you probably know. There, the comprehensive peace agreement was signed in 2005, so the southern Sudan has had peace for... Most of southern Sudan has been peaceful for the last 4 years. And there's been a few skirmishes here and there. You might have heard of one just a week ago in the eastern part of southern Sudan. But in Maria Alba, they've been able to begin rebuilding. And so how has that changed, and what's the mood of the town now?
A lot of things have happened in Maria Alba and in many places in South Sudan. The Comprehensive Peace Agreement gave South the opportunity to reestablish itself and develop. And now there are many roads connecting major towns in South Sudan. And with those roads, also many internally displaced people have been able to return to their homes. Maria Alba, which has less than 1,000 people in December 2003, now has more than 7,000 people. You know? And so many of the internally displaced people have returned home, but they are facing challenges of, reestablishing themselves. Water situation is not good. Food is still a problematic, and medical health is still an issue. But I'm happy just to tell you that a lot of people have come back and are willing and determined to build their homes. And that's all you see in South Sudan. You see people working. This is Mariel Bay in December 2003. We wouldn't even see somebody or a lady wearing a dress like that.
This was taken, what, a few weeks ago?
Yeah, this was
taken. This is in the middle of the market?
Yeah, this was taken. They have market days, and this picture was taken in the morning. So on market days, many people come to the market. Things are sold at cheaper prices. And so even in the morning, you see a crowd of people beginning to get together in the market.
And when we were there in 2001, they weren't even having market days. Like there wasn't anything like this.
You could remember the only thing we could find locally was groundnut.
Yeah. So this is you can see off to the right is Valentino's family compound. And can you tell us about this tree?
This tree, personally, this is a historic tree. This is where I was playing under this tree when the Morahalin came. And when I was separated from my family, I was playing with kids under this tree. They still use the traditional method of farming. And you see this boy, they're farming with the donkey.
Did I already? Oh, who? Tell us who's in this picture.
This one is my mother, the one wearing red, and that is me, and we are dancing. I don't know what was happening. Maybe you remember.
That was. This was.
Is that
a
when
year
we were
ago,
given the land for? For the school.
So yeah. Back in, was that 2006?
2007.
2007. We went back and. And Valentino had put together a plan. He formed a foundation, the Valentino Ashok Deng Foundation. And I'm going to let you tell about the plans of it. But the point of the trip was to sort of present the ideas and go on sort of a listening tour to the community. And but also, they had a celebration in Valentino's compound here. So that's his mom there in the red. And this is a traditional dance that you did pretty well for not you didn't grow up doing you didn't have the benefit of all the same sort of customs that you would have grown up with had you grown up with your family.
Yeah, but in the camp I was training youth, and as an actor you have to be active and do something practically.
So what was the idea for the foundation?
The idea was to build a secondary school, in South Sudan. The multilateral NGOs and the regional government is investing in education, but most of them are providing primary school education. Very few or none are engaged in the secondary school education. So we decided that there are kids who will be finishing primary school. Where would they go? Therefore, we decided that building a secondary school, would provide this kid with hope that there's another level to go. And also, from secondary school, they can attend vocational training institutes and be able to be productive members of the society. So we went back and we shared our ideas with the community, and the community gave us the land. They donated a big land to us. And then we hold a groundbreaking ceremony.
Oh, this is some of the...
And you see, these are students. That is me and the bricks. We bought bricks from the local brick camps. And this is our first team of builders in Mara Elbai.
Now, when you presented the idea of building a school, was everyone immediately sold on it? And did they believe that you were going to do this?
No, the community was so skeptic, especially the leaders and the chiefs. They couldn't believe that we were going to build a second school. That is something that they expect maybe a government or a big multilateral NGO could do, but not us. And also, this is a community where some individuals have come, promised, and left, and not fulfilled their promises. So I understood the reason why they were skeptic. But we told them, you also were there, that we will build the school. And then we came back to the U.S., put together a plan, and started. This was the ground. This is the foundation now. Well, and you see, people are carrying bricks on their shoulders. Everything we do there is with the hand, even timbers sometimes. Maybe we will get to the point where we have a truck.
Well, I just want to say how remarkable it was. We would have these gatherings with dozens of elders and men and women and community leaders and educators, and everybody was totally behind Valentino's idea and very, very dedicated to helping in any way. But at the same time, slowly you found out that there was a little bit of, we'll wait and see. And they granted all this land right away and were for it. And so there was an optimism and sort of a sense of hope, and everyone came together. There were thousands of people that gathered and had a celebration of blessing the land. But then it's another thing to prove it.
Yeah, well, the way I put it today is that they were a skeptic, but they knew that something could happen or something could not. So all they did was show us their contribution. They gave us the land, and then they waited to see what we would do.
When was the groundbreaking?
The groundbreaking was in June, the last year. And so I went to Kampala, bought cement and many construction material. And the moment they saw that big trucks arriving in Mara Elbai, the project became the talk of the village.
Well, first Valentino bought like a 16-wheel truck, right? How many wheels does it have? I don't know how to count trucks.
We bought a big truck. And a small Toyota Hilux. And that was to help us with logistics. And because we were to buy construction material from Kampala and drive for 7 days. You know, businessmen who have a truck were charging us 12,000 one trip. I said I could not afford that. Let me buy a truck for 30,000. And then I could save more that I would spend on renting trucks. And so that's what I did, and it saved us, way too much.
And we don't have the photos here. I forgot to put them in, but there's actually, Valentino took photos of himself negotiating and handing over the money for the truck, which was, he sent them to me, because Valentino is like the shrewdest negotiator I've ever been around. Like when we're in the market in Nairobi just buying souvenirs, I stay totally quiet, and I just sit there. And he just berates these craftspeople down to the right price, so that I get a local price. I'll talk more about it because Valentino won't brag about it. But Valentino is the head of this organization, makes every decision, and has hired all local staff and builders. And it's such a lean and incredibly efficient organization that you'll see what came of it in so short of a time. So this is the old truck, one of the old trucks.
This was the Hilux, our first Hilux. And the roads are so muddy sometimes it feels like driving on the snow.
Yeah. And then when the roads can't be passed with a car,
then the horse cart is the option. We have many means. These are the only two girls who are attending a correspondent secondary school in Marial Bay, this guy told me that many of their peers, you know, had to be married off early. Girls have tough time following, pursuing their education in southern Sudan because they still bright price pay for marriage, and many families still see in girls as a fine sense of wealth. And what we want to do with our school is that we will build a boarding facility for girls so that when we admit them, they leave on campus and they only will get to go home for 1 month and then, you know, for holidays. And by doing that, I think we will limit, you know, things like how they are forced to work and not study when they go to day school. We will limit things like them thinking about being married, but now thinking about book and studying. But we still will allow them to be meeting with the family. But our target is to get 60% of our students as girls.
So these were taken over the summer, right?
It was... these were taken during the rainy season, the beginning of the rainy season last year. Most of these, We formed an advisory council made up of all the local chiefs and administrators and politicians. And because I was dealing with the community, bargaining with builders and bargaining with the brick makers, and so many people want to sell their brick at the same time, and they were not patient enough to understand that if I buy Dave's brick today, tomorrow I'll buy Bill's brick. But so I formed an advisory council of local leaders who now were in charge to talk and handle cases like that. And even when it comes to admitting girls into our school, this advisory council will still be instrumental.
And I should point out, we had a picture of your dad early on. It didn't come up. This is your dad in the light blue and the cowboy hat, fourth from the right. So we maybe, if we have time, we'll talk about his affection for cowboy hats later. Now, who is this group?
This is the Women Committee. We, in the market, there are women who make tea, and this is a community where almost everything, every house core is done by women. And we felt so sympathetic, so we started a small groups of women, and our goal is to eventually train them in entrepreneurship and give them money, and they can expand their businesses and support their own families. And also, this is where our matrons, who will be handling girls in our school, will come.
So this is also over the summer, I think.
Yeah, this is our construction in progress. We bought textbooks. That's the truck.
Yeah, both trucks. You can see Valentino's logo on the side of that one. Which I didn't know that you would put logos on the trucks even. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, now we have two motorcycles. We have a Land Cruiser and a truck. We bought Land Cruiser less than a month ago.
And if you don't have your own vehicles, you're at the mercy of everybody.
You're at the mercy of the businessman will prey on you.
So when did this happen? This was a celebration, local school kids.
In August last year, we invited school students from Marial Bay area to our school to explain to them the idea of the second school. And this, that was a girls' school. Those people dancing were all girls. And we thought that only maybe 300 students would show up, but to our surprise, there were more than 3,000 students. Yeah, they were marching out just from school that I haven't been told about. Like, these are different schools. And
so when was this next one taken?
This picture was taken, I should say,
just
less than a month ago.
Yeah, about a month ago.
Less than a month ago.
So these are two of the buildings. And you can't see the teachers' quarters that are over beyond and to the left, but there'll be quarters for teachers from locally, and so that they have a place to live, or if they come from Kenya or Uganda.
Yes.
And then there'll also be this is a whole square courtyard in the middle, another teacher's office building over there, a library here. Valentino drew it all out.
Thank you.
That's all the librarians in the audience, I think? Yeah, all right. This was, what are they doing here?
2 weeks ago, we started registering students. We're starting classes on April 30th. And then just the turnout is so enormous. This is the only second school in the entire region.
But this was a flyer that you posted at a nearby school?
Yes, we posted on the
nearby
tree.
Town? Yeah. This is a different town with a flyer.
This is a different town. These are girls. This is a painting. Somebody's painting the walls. And
so
the school painted now.
This was what, 3 or 4 days
this
ago?
Yeah, 3 or 4 days ago. That's
now,
the school.
Where's the picture of Lake? I don't know if we... There's a guy named Lake Majak who's the chief engineer, and he had been a builder in Khartoum for many years and moved back to Mario Bay, and he pulled off all of this... You know, all of the masonry and the building, and I mean, he's incredible.
Actually, there was a first guy I assigned to be the chief engineer or builder, and then Lake was working as one of his supervisors. And through the construction process, I realized that Lake was more skilled than the boss. And then the boss was not on work. He would drive to town and spend most of the day there, and Lake is doing the work. So one of the day I decided that, you know, I better go with Lake because they are the same anyway. And we relieved the other guy and was left with Lake. And then Lake surprised us. He told us that he didn't need money. He wanted to show us his skill, and he has 9 children and he wanted them to go to this school. So why put the money first? And Lake was displaced. He was in the camp in Khartoum and had worked with a professional builder in Khartoum. That's where he learned all of this. He doesn't read or write. But you can tell him to do something and he will say, oh, okay, I understand it, I will do it. He's the one who built all of this harkis. But Lake is the one in charge of everything we see, the one who built it.
There was some day that he came up with these arches, right? And he just started doing them, and it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
This whole sort of, you know, walkway that goes in between, and this whole, you know, kind of promenade, or I don't know what you call it, colonnade, between, so there's that outdoor area where students can sit in the shade. Mm-hmm. And these are what? These are the first two students registered?
The first two girl students registering.
Like a few days ago.
And then these are also our future student. All of this.
So I have to ask, though, I think that there's some people here that have worked for nonprofits before, and here and abroad, and what you've pulled off in under a year, even with like many months of rainy season where almost nothing can be done, and you're one guy, and you're employing local people, and you have a guy here, Greg, who is an American, and a few other volunteers, but on the ground, it's you. Mm-hmm. How do you do this? I mean, I think it's sort of a miracle. And there's, you know, in southern Sudan, we've gone around a lot, and we've researched a lot of other schools and stuff before you started, and there's not a whole lot of success of people trying to pull off a project like you did. And for a budget and in the speed that you did it, like what, I think everybody wants to know sort of what's your secret.
You know, I come from the same community where I am building. So when it comes to bargaining and also, knowing the challenges, both the weather challenges and how to get material to Mariel by, I was quick to figure out what I need. And then I didn't go to look for expatriate in Kenya or Uganda. I just used the local community. I knew that there were builders there who I would give job and supervise closely, which is one reason I had to spend much of my time in there, and they would do the work. And second to that too, I told the community that we are a small organization. We do not have money. We even want the community's contribution. And people were willing to contribute. But again, the difference that with big organization, sometimes you bring in somebody who will have to study the community longer. You know, how someone who sometimes might be taken advantage of. And the time it takes to get oneself acquainted with the local community, affect the progress that one can make. There's some time where big money is intended for a big project, but then it ends up not meeting the end. But with us, we know the community where we're working, we know what we're bringing, and it was easier for me to work with the community that I understand well.
Well, from when Valentino started, he said it would be open in April 2009. It's open in April 2009, and classes will begin in a few days. And eventually, within a few months, there'll be hundreds of students. It's going to start smaller, but then eventually there'll be about 400 students. And my last question before we open up some audience questions is, people hear about tensions along the border between North and South again, and people worry about the fragile peace in southern Sudan. And I think some people say, well, how do you feel about building a school that's such a hopeful and such a fragile thing, too, and such a beautiful thing to put so many hundreds of thousands of hours of effort and money? Do you have a sense of, concern about will this last and what's going to happen in the future? Or do you feel like,
We have the Comprehensive Peace Agreement is alive. We have a peace in southern Sudan. And one of the ways to maintain that peace is to build, develop, support the community. And then they will be able to realize the fruit of peace. So if we stay out and say that maybe this school will not run, then I might be afraid of something that might not happen. Many people in southern Sudan have started to do tangible things. There are roads that are constructed across the country. There are shops coming up. There are even some Skye Crepes Foundation already started in Juba. So I do not worry that the peace will not hold. The peace will hold. And one of the things that will hold this peace is development. If we make these internally displaced people who have returned home, if we give them things to do, if we empower them with money, with activities, recreational activities, with schools, with training, then an educated community is very difficult to pull back to war. But if we wait it until after several years and then hope that the peace will hold, that peace event can turn out to be a disaster. So I think that peace will hold in South Sudan, and there are good things happening and good things need to be done there. But also in Darfur, I'm very worried about Darfur because I would hope that a fresh negotiation between the rebels and the government in Khartoum takes place, and to the parties who want to stop the war in Darfur, I think our goal would be to pressure both the government and the rebel to sit at a round table and negotiate. because only these parties at conflict can bring peace to that region. And our role would be to push them to accept going onto that table and see who doesn't want to negotiate. And peace also will come to Darfur.
We'll take some questions, I think, on cards.
Yes, I know that a lot of you had really wonderful questions. One of the questions that just seems to fit right here, someone asked, I know that the proceeds from the book, including any payment Dave would have received, went to the foundation to build the school. Was that enough? And if we would like to get involved, how can we get involved? And
good
what a great question. Thanks for that one.
That's a very good question. Who asked it?
That read like a plant. Well,
yeah.
Done.
I should say that one of the reasons that it took us long to finish the school now was because of the funding. I had to travel back to Sudan and come back to the U.S. to raise funds to push up to this level. Otherwise, construction of this building can just take me three. If I have money to go back with it tomorrow, next month you will see that the girls' dormitory building are complete and the boys' dormitory building are complete. Because if we have money, we can put many projects going together at the same time, and we'll have to be doing one at a time. Yeah. So we are in need of support. The money from the book was a lot, and I should thank Dave for donating all of that. Money from the book was a lot, but we are still in need of more support. I should also thank, from our donation list, many people from Marine have supported us. I should say that this county is the lifeline of our project. Truly, because many of the people who have donated to our project come from this community. I thank you for that, and I would also thanks your more support to our program.
The next question is about the other boys that are in who were in the book. This person wants to know, have you been in touch with them? Can you tell us about any of them and where they are today?
There are some of them that we killed in the book, but they are alive. The reason for that was because, you know, maybe one of them had to carry different characters, and if he's unlucky that the character was dead, then we kill him. But by William Kay is alive, he's in Vancouver, and he's actually and he's actually building a clinic in southern Sudan.
Well, we should say that it's not the same William Kay. We took William Kay's name.
Yes.
There was a boy that was lost in the way that William Kay was, but
yeah,
it was a name.
And William had to carry the story.
Yeah. We'll have to skip through again. We'll go to the next question.
Okay. This person would like to know, did the robbery in Atlanta really happen? It was such a dramatic beginning to the book. And is that true?
It's true. The robbery happened, but one thing I must tell you is that I was one of thousands of people who would be robbed and beaten in their house, and maybe, unfortunately, many people die. So I was lucky that I survived that incident. And the only thing I would say today is that if that group of people showed up today, I would say, don't do that again. But I have forgiven them, and it could happen anywhere because it's a crime sense and criminals choose targets. And I was unfortunate that I became the target at that time.
This person, people want to know what's true, I think. This person wants to know if the man Valentino happened upon in the desert with the bicycle was a hallucination, or was there a man on the bicycle?
Dave could answer this question.
You know, I think that I don't want to reveal every last... but, you know, the book was... I guess I'll answer the question of why it's called a novel, which is sort of what comes up a lot. And that is that we worked on it for about 3 years with the understanding that it would be nonfiction, and that it would be, at first I just told it as a journalist, because that was my background, and I was sort of saying, Valentino this, and this and that. And it sounded like me at the time. I couldn't get rid of my voice, and I felt like I didn't belong anywhere at all in this narrative. And when we went back in 2003, I wrote an account of that trip, and I really didn't like being anywhere in that story, whether physically or my voice, and I felt like I was in the way. And so eventually, using Valentino's voice, or an approximation on the page, became the right solution. And then when we realized that there were holes in the story where Valentino, as a very young boy, couldn't remember exactly what happened on this day of the journey to Ethiopia or things like that, what somebody actually said on a given day, the need to have actual dialogue, to be able to paint scenes, to be able to make a narrative that that coheres and is compelling, it isn't just a dry relation of those facts that can be proven. This was all of these different reasons conspired to make it sort of necessary to make it a novel. But I had given up the book. I was actually writing up in Jenner, in a cabin up there. My wife and I had rented and for a month to get this written, and I had given up, and I was actually cowering in a corner of this cabin, like, I can't do it right. And I felt like I had wasted 3 years of Valentino's time, and I could not pull it off. And I was, you know, I wouldn't say I was, it was a breakdown, but I was definitely giving up. And that day, you know, Vendela, my wife, said, well, okay, then give it up, and we'll figure out a way to, you know, get Valentino's story out there that, you know, in some other way. And then, having given it up that afternoon, it all opened up, and I said, well, if we can just call it a novel and be able to have these little bridges here and there, or create a scene with dialogue, things like that, and describe a man's face that Valentino can't remember right now, that would make it come alive, and that would sort of be able to make this story that I knew was so extraordinary reach everyone here. And if it had been a dry account, then we wouldn't all be here. And so, that's what. And I call Valentino the next day after sort of thinking it over, and I said, well, is this okay? Can we call it a novel? Can I sort of paint these scenes a little bit, breathe some life into them? And he was like, well, I just assumed that you were doing that anyway, you know? And, because, you know, Valentino was an educator at Kakuma, and he had to think of different ways to get a story across, whether it was educating youth about HIV/AIDS or whatever and using puppets, or whether it was dramatizing in a one-act play, you know, conflict resolution between parties. And so Valentino was a master at always knowing how to communicate something, how best to sort of get a story across. And so I was sort of, you know, educated there about the need to do what's necessary to make the story as true as possible. And that's what we were able to do by being able to call it a novel. And so Valentino did meet a man in the middle of the desert when there was a truck that came in the middle of the night, and he and all the other boys fled in many different directions and got stuck on a barbed wire fence that Valentino still has a scar from, and met this man. And then from there, there was some dialogue and go from there. Yeah. But this was a man that, like so many, had survived the war by basically disappearing, by not taking sides, he continued to exist by not existing, you might say.
That was absolutely wonderful. Before we end, I'd like to mention that one of my favorite books right now published by McSweeney's, the publishing company that Dave helped found, edited by Dave with a foreword by Valentino, is Out of Exile. And it is a nonfiction, I think, treatment of what has happened with the... Could you tell us just a tiny bit about it, and then we'll stop.
When we were back in 2003, Valentino and I met three women who had been abducted and enslaved during the Civil War, and they had been recently returned to Mario Bay, and they told us their story, and we decided that their story had to be told in some way, too, and so we interviewed them then, and then we interviewed other women in, back in 2006 and 7, and out of that came Out of Exile, a collection of oral histories from men and women who had a myriad experiences during the war. And Craig Walzer, a fantastic journalist and writer, put most of it together, and we did a few of the interviews and an introduction, and it's available if you want to do further reading. Is that good?
It's here.
I'm talking as fast as I can.
And speaking of the books, Dave and Valentino have graciously agreed to sign the books, and if you'll come up after we finish, we're going to go. The books are being sold over there. If you need some more, my colleague Karen West will help organize how, and the volunteers, getting it all done in such an easy way that everyone will have time to get a book signed. And to Dave and Valentino.
Oh, before you wrap up, are you about to wrap up?
I was.
Oh, okay. I want to give you the wrap up.
Oh, okay.
But I just
give
wanted
me the wrap
to.
Up.
Two announcements. One, here's another picture of a roux. We were putting this together, and Valentino was like, put another roux in there. All right. So, if anybody wants to volunteer or get involved with the Valentino Ashok Deng Foundation here in the U.S., May 12th, 12 noon, 849 Valencia Street, we're going to have an informational reading and talk more about it if anybody wants to be a part. And this is the... the wrap-up, because Valentino is, again, not to brag, this is, I will sell it for him. What he's done is incredible. You've seen just the beginnings, even, of it, of what he's done in Mario Bay with very little funding. The funding is running out. All the books that you bought, every book pays for bricks. The book, especially in hardcover, is about as heavy as a brick, and it pays for bricks. But there's a point where that's not going to do it. And especially to pay salaries for teachers to keep the school alive, more support is needed. And so if you're ever inclined that way, you know that this is the leanest organization ever created. It's not going to administration and huge overhead. This is going to... actually put bricks and mortar together and paint walls and school supplies and desks. And so if you want to learn more about it, there's more pictures and video and information on valentinoashokdeng.org. You can talk to us afterward. And if you want to learn more, again, May 12th, it's a Tuesday in San Francisco, or you can contact Valentino or Greg Larson, who runs things from here. A young man, you can contact him too. And there's going to be a table out there with Mary Dane, who volunteers for the organization. She'll be there to answer any questions too. Sorry to blab a lot, but I'm so astonished by what Valentino's pulled off, and that I want everybody to get involved in any way they can.
And in our school, we have computer labs and science labs that lacks equipment. So if people can support us on that, we'll appreciate
it. You want to sum up sort of this whole, experience of...
Did you want me to sum up?
No, I was saying Valentino.
Valentino to sum up.
Will
you just sum up the whole thing?
I honestly want to give my heartfelt appreciation to all of you for sparing your valuable time to be here tonight. You know, the program started maybe 3 months ago, and you have consistently been following up with that. We're winding it up tonight. That's why I am no longer on Skype, but with you physically. And I just want to thank you so much, and I have you in my heart. You have read the story, spread the word, and for me it's the time I'm doing things at the school I'm doing in Marialbai. It's the project I want to see complete. I would like to see kids smiling in classes. I would like to see them going to school every day. And with your support, we have been able to do that. Keep the faith, and I will remember you always. Thank you.
There's nothing I could say that could make. We've only just begun. We have the whole rest of the year to keep reading.
All right, folks, that will wrap it up, tonight's ILS presentation. And a moving one at that. This broadcast will be available for download within the next few hours. And you'll be able to grab it from radio.dominican.edu's website. Save it forever. Enjoy it again and again. Appreciate you spending some time with us tonight. Stuart Horn signing off for radio.dominican.edu, where we have been broadcasting live from Angelico Concert Hall at Dominican University of California, worldwide. On radio.dominican.edu.